You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality. We should have come up with something funny there. Just added babes to the end of it or something.
It's coming into the summer. I'm too warm and tired to be funny.
Yeah, that's fair enough. This is why we have the summer off. This is why we don't record when it's warm. Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and I am joined by Connor. Hello, Connor.
Hello.
Don't get excited. We're not back. We're definitely not back. We are an off-air podcast. We're enjoying a nice sort of slightly extended break. It's the longest break we've had since we started doing this. But rather annoyingly, Russell T. Davis has decided to give us a new series of Doctor Who while we're off air, which I think is very selfish. He should have consulted with us beforehand. But for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason he didn't. So here we are talking about new television episodes of Doctor Who when we're supposed to not be talking about Doctor Who. Never mind, though, eh? Worse things have happened.
It's Doctor Who. Well, that's, you know, we're Doctor Who fans. We're just here to complain. You know, it's in the job description.
Yes, so we are.
How dare they put it back on the TV and not leave it off the air for another 16 years.
No, personally, I'm outraged that there are new episodes of Doctor Who. It's not on. And they need to stop doing that sort of thing. It's just dreadful. But seeing as Doctor Who is on the telly at the moment, we should probably talk about it, because I don't know about you, I'm really enjoying this new series. I think Shooty's a great Doctor. I'm really enjoying this sort of new kind of Doctor-companion dynamic that we're getting with the Doctor and Ruby. It's different to any other Doctor-companion relationship we've seen before. And it's working. I like it. So before we sort of dive into episodes, what do you think about the Doctor, about Ruby, and this latest TARDIS team?
I think they are extremely watchable. I think they're an awful lot of fun on screen, and I love the energy that the two of them have. Millie Gibson is absolutely the highlight of the series, I think, as Ruby Sunday. She has very clearly shown her acting chops, as it were. You know, she's been brilliant in every single episode, and certainly something like 73 Yards focusing in on her and giving her a whole episode, you know, as a character piece, it couldn't have gone better, you know, as far as her performance went.
It was the first one that she recorded as well, which is mental.
I know, and that's
insane just how good she is in it.
It's an absolute testament to how good she is. Shooty Gatwa is very, very watchable. I run slightly hot and cold on him as the Doctor. I think there's episodes where he seems more doctory, and then there's other episodes where he's maybe less doctory. That's not a bad thing. You know, show evolves, etc., etc. The character evolves. I think for a Doctor, there's always a higher bar for me to get them compared to a companion, because in my mind, I'm comparing Shooty Gatwa against the first 17 other people who have played the role, whereas Millie Gibson's playing a brand new character. She can make it her own. I always would prefer to leave it to the end of a series to say, yes, I like this person as the Doctor, or no, I don't. I'm really liking watching Shooty Gatwa. He's great. Very, very talented and accomplished actor. For Doctor Who, I don't like to pin myself to yes, good Doctor, or no, not so good Doctor, until I've seen at least a series.
I I think you can apply this to just about any Doctor, I think. The first series is their weakest from the Doctor, the character performance point of view. And a writing point of view as well, I guess. You know, writers are getting their head around this new Doctor. It's a bit different with this one because Russell T. Davies has written so much of it. And the other person that we've had a story from so far is Stephen Moffat, who has also written so much of it. But I do think it takes a full series for a Doctor to settle in. Like, I much prefer Series 3 David Tennant to Series 2. I prefer Series 6 Matt Smith to Series 5. Definitely prefer Series 9 Capaldi to Series 8. So it's nothing here surprising me. Jodie Whittaker got a lot better as she went on. So I'm not surprised by people not instantly falling in love with the new Doctor, because I think historically there's definitely a trend there. And I think this time next year we'll be sat here going, oh my God, he's one of the best ever, because we'll have had time to watch this series, watch it again, let it sink in and see what happens throughout the next one too.
Do you know what I think hasn't helped? I always view sort of the first three episodes of a series as a little trilogy to establish a Doctor or a new companion. And in this case, it's both. So you've got, we had Space Babies, Devil's Court, and Boom, all three very different episodes. But then we lost the Doctor and there was two Doctor Light stories. And I think that maybe killed the momentum slightly. Where we haven't really seen all that much of the Doctor for the last 2 weeks. And before that, we only had three episodes in the series with him. So I think that maybe has robbed the momentum, where just as the Doctor is starting to establish himself in my mind, we lose him for a fortnight and we're only really getting him back in Rogue. We're recording this on a Friday morning. Rogue's coming out tonight. This is the most we're going to have seen of the Doctor since Boom, and Boom feels like a fairly long time ago as far as the series goes. So I think that hasn't helped, but he's great. I'm loving his performance. I just want to reserve judgment to see how the series pans out. There's things I like and there's things I'm less sure about. And I want to see where it settles.
Like two Doctor Light episodes. I've really missed him. Definitely. But yes. By all accounts, he is back this week.
Yes, and it looks we had the Beatles, which you could say is a historical. This is, in my mind, more of a historical because it's further back in history. The Beatles is relatively recent history. It's not as maybe as much of a period piece as this is, where we're going full Regency, full ball gowns and costumes and hair and whatnot. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yes, we shall. We'll see what happens. But let's talk about what we've had so far. So we've done an episode on Church on Ruby Road. We don't need to talk about that again. It obviously set up an awful lot, and what it setups kind of been continued throughout the series. You know, we have got stuff about Ruby's parentage and the snow is appearing and various other little bits, but it's not been as full on as I kind of predicted it would be. You know, I thought we'd have seen more of Mrs. Flood by now, and I thought there'd be, you know, more stuff about Ruby's parentage. We've had a very, very Ruby-focused episode, and it hardly touched on it at all, which I thought was quite interesting. So, I mean, Russell T. Davies did at the time say it's all going to be a slow burn. Don't expect to know everything within a few weeks. So I was quite surprised, sort of conversely, when the first two episodes came along. And episode two in particular, The Devil's Chord, was very, 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 it felt very storyline heavy. You know, it picked up a lot from the 60th specials, and it definitely sort of left a few things hanging that we're going to explore, presumably, later on. But I'm jumping ahead. We're not at The Devil's Chord yet. We're at Space Babies, which is one hell of a weird opener. Like, I feel as though they were perhaps showing off the new Disney budget a little bit with this one, in a sort of slightly weird way. It worked as a series opener. I think if it sort of popped up in the middle of a series, I wouldn't like it as much as I did, but as sort of establishing this TARDIS team dynamic, what it's going to be, all that kind of thing, I thought it worked. There was a lot of info dumping in there. There was a lot of, this is the TARDIS, I'm the Doctor, I'm from Gallifrey. Or, you know, we're obviously at a jumping on point here, but it feels like this is maybe the third jumping on point we've had in the space of 6 months.
It's not wrong. You know, it's not wrong.
Well, you know, was the Star Beast not a jumping on point? Was the Church on Ruby Road not a jumping on point? So Space Babies is... It feels like more of a jumping on point because we have got all the back to basics in there, which it needed. It needed to be in there. I'm glad we got it out of the way. I think the best word I could use to describe Space Babies, though, is functional. Like, it serves a purpose. It serves that purpose well. It's not the strongest series opener we've had. It's not the strongest series opener we've had from Russell T. Davis. But it absolutely does what it needs to do. And I'm in. Instantly watching this episode, I was like, okay, yeah, if this is going to be it, if this series is going to pan out after this opening episode, as other series have panned out after their opening episode, yeah, I'm going to enjoy this. I was watching it kind of feeling like it was serving a purpose, but it still entertained me. I still enjoyed it, but I kind of know what the TARDIS is at this stage because I've been around for quite a few jumping on points. What did you think, Connor?
I think Space Babies is a wee bit of...
Welcome back. We've not podcasted for 2 months and this is it. We're done.
I can't talk anymore.
Thank God for that.
I think Space Babies was a little bit of a mixed bag. It's weird, as you say, about the whole jumping on, the jumping on point thing, because that's... It's not a problem I've had. I would never call it a problem because the jumping on points are not aimed at me who have been, you know, I've been watching Doctor Who for 20 years or whatever it is now. Oh my God, it's been 20 years. But I don't know where the jumping on point's meant to be, because if you start with the Church on Ruby Road, fine, no problem. That's probably the best place to jump on with this stuff. You can jump on with Space Babies, sure, but then you're missing out on the Doctor and Ruby meeting. So I don't know why they tried to make Space Babies a jumping on point, because it's picking up after these two characters have already met. And you get that big info dump at the start, which sort of treads back over that old Russell Time War, Gallifrey's gone, guilting, you know, that the Doctor has this survivor's guilt, which the 14th Doctor going into Time Lord therapy was meant to have fixed. He wasn't meant to be carrying this weight around, and yet the 15th Doctor still is. Fine, it makes for good TV, it makes for drama, conflict, etc., etc. But it's sort of contradicting the whole point of the specials and the whole point of the 14th Doctor. And I think we're too soon after that to forget about that. So that's okay. If you go back to the specials as the jumping on point, because you sort of have to, because we know in the finale that we're going back to UNIT and Rose Noble's going to be there. And then if you're wondering where she's come from, you have to go and watch the 50th or the 60th anniversary specials. And if you want to watch those, you have to go back and watch series 4. And if you want to watch series 4, you have to watch series 1 to 3, etc. So there's no jumping on point. There is no jumping on point here. Anyway, that's beside the point. Space Babies was okay. I thought I came away having liked it because I thought it was a very Russell T. Davies run of the mill Doctor Who story, which is a vibe I like, and reminds me of watching it the first time round. I like the energy to it. I was going to say I like the humor. I like some of the humor. So one of my favorite things about Space Babies and sort of about this new Doctor in general is he's a very mischievous scamp. There's 2 points in Space Babies where it's when they're up in the little control room with all the babies and he sort of goes out of his way to scare them. he talks about the monster and they all scream, and he talks some more about the monster and they all scream again, and he puts the monster up on the TV screen on the wall and they all scream and start crying, and the doctor's nearly doubled over with, you know, laughing. I thought that was really funny, just because he seems to be a real prankster and a bit of a joker, and almost sort of likes scaring others in a fairly harmless sort of way, just to get his own kicks out of it. I think that's really funny. He does the same sort of thing with Ruby later on when she realizes she's covered in snot, that he twigs before, and he's trying to tell her this and break it to her while he's trying not to laugh. I think that's a really great little character note. And I love that. I love that this is an element of this new Doctor. Having mentioned the snot and the fact that the monster's made of snot and the fact that the spaceship moves as the result of a pent-up 6-year fart, it's going back to that old sort of Slitheen-style toilet humour that I certainly have moved past, and I think the show should have moved past, and I'm a little disappointed that we went back to it. I think it's not a style of humour I'm disposed to anymore, and sure, maybe I laughed when I was 7 or 8 years old watching Series 1 and the Slitheen. It's a bit of a throwback and a wee bit too much of a throwback, I think, for me. So I could have done without some of those elements that didn't make for terribly pleasant watching, but it was fine. I thought some of the jokes were good. Certainly the whole thing with Nanny's swearing filter, and you can tell exactly what she's saying to the doctor over the intercom. I think like he gets called "you illegitimate child" or something at some stage, and obviously that's not what Nanny said. I thought that was really funny, and it was a nice little detail to listen out for. It was a Russell T Davies series opener. They're usually fairly average, run-of-the-mill, 7 out of 10 sort of stories. I think that's fair enough to call Space Babies that. I had fun watching it, and I liked it on watching, with a few caveats here and there. So it did its job. It's, as you say, it's very functional. It did a job it had to do and mostly accomplished it. So I think that's fair enough.
I did kind of feel as though, just going back to the burping, farting stuff, there was actually quite a lot in there that we've had before, for better or for worse. Like, you know, we're still talking about the bin burp 20 years later, the bin burp in Rose, and the Slitheen farting. But there's other stuff like that, sort of, you know, cutting out at the point where a character's going to swear. We did that in New Earth, you know, you're talking out of your ask not, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it certainly felt as though we were retreading very, very familiar Russell T Davies territory.
There's the whole thing as well with him sonicking her phone and her calling her mum back on Earth. It's a shot-for-shot remake, nearly, of that scene in End of the World, where the Ninth Doctor did the same with Rose's phone. And that was that there was no, that wasn't even a reference. That was just remaking that sequence. You can do that 20 years down the line. That's no problem. But it's a bit weird when it's the same writer doing the exact same story beat with a very similar Doctor and Companion sort of team. Because I think Ruby comes from a very similar sort of place to Rose, almost. You can see a lot of comparisons between Ruby and Rose. And it felt a bit strange to see the exact same scene with two different Doctors and Companions who are, when you sort of dig into it, quite similar.
Yeah, I get why that kind of stuff needs to be done and needs to be established, but you've had 20 years to think of a second way of doing that, Russell. Maybe we could have done that instead. But it's a very, very minor nitpick. But yeah, it feels as though we're going over some greatest and some not so greatest hits from 20 years ago. But it's, you know, it worked. It was immensely successful. Russell T Davies knows what he's doing far better than I do. So I'm happy to kind of go, if we needed it, we needed it. But let's move on. And with episode 2, I feel as though we did move on. So this is The Devil's Chord, which was, I think it's fair to say this was probably the one that received the most sort of pre-series preview press, that kind of thing. You know, we saw Jinx Monsoon's Maestro very early on. It was one of the first things kind of announced about this new series. And it was great. The character was great. And I really hope that we've got a recurring villain there. And I do think that we need some new recurring villains. We seem to be still doing Daleks, Cybermen, Sontarans, Angels, which is a cycle we've been in for a good 15 years now. Let's have a new recurring villain. Let's have something different. And I think that maybe the Maestro could be that. The episode itself, I thought the structure was a little bit strange. I think having the Beatles in Doctor Who is a great idea. I'm surprised we've not done that before. But to kind of have them feature heavily in the first 10 minutes and then disappear just to come back at the end and kind of sort everything out, I thought that was a bit strange. I did like the Pyramids of Mars style trip to the future, or the present day to us, but the future to the Beatles era depicted in the episode, and oh look, the world's been destroyed. A definite sort of link to Sutek there. I think maybe that's Russell T. Davis going to longer term fans. Look, this villain is on the level of Sutek. That's what we're doing here. We're messing about with gods, which we kind of knew, kind of been established already. But I liked that little sequence. It was a strong episode. It was a strong second episode. And as I said before, it felt as though it was quite storyline heavy. I think it's probably the most storyline heavy episode we've had so far this series. But it kind of didn't really answer anything. It just continued stuff that was set up in the 60th specials, which again kind of makes me think, well, no, Space Babies wasn't the jumping on point. But yeah, it was overall, it was good. I just think that perhaps we had a villain that kind of outclassed the episode they were in. So I definitely want to see more of the Maestro. I definitely hope they come back. And I can't imagine Russell T. Davis resisting. You know, how we brought back Cassandra for New Earth. Surely the Maestro's got to come back in a similar way. He says less than 5 minutes after going, come on, Russell, do something different. But, you know, I don't care. Great villain. Need to come back. Connor, your go.
I liked it. And I think I like it more maybe looking back in retrospect now than I did at the time. Certainly sort of as I've seen the episode since. So, yes, I thought this was great. I loved Maestro. And I loved that Maestro sort of, so the whole thing is that the Maestro took the toy maker and expanded on that mythos in a really cool way, where you've added this whole new character and they've tied into this big bit of Doctor Who lore that we know is going to be a thing going forward about the toy maker and his legions and the pantheon around that. So I love that we've got this little addition that calls to mind the toy maker, but does something different. It's like a different reflection of the toy maker, or a different facet of their character represented through Maestro. And I thought that was fantastic. Like I knew there was hype going into this story. I knew about Maestro and I knew she was going to be a powerful, or she or they was going to be a powerful villain. But what changed it for me was when Maestro first climbs out of that piano, you hear the giggle. And it's done once with Maestro's voice, and then it's repeated with the Toymaker's voice. That changed the whole thing, because suddenly this goes from being an episode of the week to being part of the larger arc that we know is going to be this whole gods and monsters thing. So, absolutely brilliant. I love that we're developing this whole thing, and it's through these really unique individual characters. I was thinking about this recently. One of my favourite types of villain is like this eldritch horror that has taken human form, and you get that in the Toymaker, you get that in Maestro. Jinx Monsoon was incredible. It was scene stealing, show stealing performance, and I loved how twisted and cruel and just downright evil that character was, and yet there's still that little bit of helplessness in them as well. In that scene with the piano, where you get her backstory and how the toy maker treated her, that was horrendous. And it totally changes how you view Maestro as a character. So I love that there's this whole, you know, eldritch horror in human form thing going on. Love that. And I loved that the Doctor got properly afraid going up against her. Just proper threat, I think, in Maestro, in a way that you don't get with a villain of the week. So love that. The whole thing with Ruby, you get it teased out here. This has been picked up on Twitter, and I know, and in a few other places. You know the music that plays whenever Maestro has her up in the air and finds the secret song in her. The song that plays is the Trickster's theme from the Sarah Jane Adventures. And I don't know whether that's deliberate. I don't know whether that's just Murray reusing an old piece, maybe unconsciously. I don't know. But it feels deliberate. And I don't know whether that's going to be a thing or whether it's just pointing to the Trickster being, your Ruby being of a similar nature to the Trickster. I would love to see the Trickster join this pantheon. I would love to see the Trickster in Doctor Who proper. I think it would be a cool way to tie back into the old Sarah Jane Adventures. And he's absolutely a villain that fits this new Gods and Monsters era. So, yeah, I loved it. And the Beatles thing, yeah, I know they weren't in it very much. That didn't really bother me. I like that it was John and Paul who saved the day. I thought it was a bit wick that Ringo and George were very sidelined, but we know now that the Beatles weren't the main point. The main point of the story was Maestro and the Pantheon. So, yeah, cool. Glad they were there to help save the day. The chord they play at the end is, it's an E major chord, which is not serious or run-of-the-mill, but it is a Beatles chord because it's the ending note of A Day in the Life. So I like that it was that little reference to their music, even though they couldn't use any of their actual tunes. So, yeah, cool. I liked it. I like it more in retrospect than I did at the time. It's grown on me an awful lot. And I loved the villain, and I loved how it ties into this ongoing story. I'd love to see Maestro again. I would love to see the Toymaker again. I think one of the best things about this sort of villain is that even though I absolutely hope if Maestro does come back, Jinx Monsoon also comes back. But I think it's sort of similar to the Doctor and even the Master, where it doesn't have to be the same actor every time. You know, we've had the Toymaker with two different faces now. There's no reason why Maestro can't keep coming back for years with a lot of different actors playing them. So that's incredible that we've got this villain who can come back, and there's so much potential for them to be a recurring villain in years to come. I loved it. I'm looking forward to seeing where this all goes.
So what you're saying is the perfect jumping on point would be the Sarah Jane Adventures.
We'll see. We'll see how that pans out.
Pantheon's out. Anyway, it's an interesting point you were making about, you know, different actors appearing as the same character. And of course, we're getting a very, very different toy maker from Big Finish. At the time of recording, in a few days, Annette Badland's going to be the toy maker in the next Fourth Doctor set, which I believe is due this coming week.
Oh, very nice.
I think I could be wrong. I'm sure I saw a tweet saying the Fourth Doctor's happening this week.
I look forward to that.
I am looking forward to that. But yeah, it was a nice solid episode. Like, there's absolutely nothing I can particularly complain about. I can sit here and nitpick, but I can sit here and nitpick about any Doctor Who story. That's just the nature of Doctor Who and indeed fandom. Episode 3, then. Let's move on to that. And this one I was particularly excited about. I don't think I've ever made any secret of the fact that Stephen Moffat writes Doctor Who more to my taste than Russell T. Davis, generally. So I was looking forward to Boom. I was looking forward to new Moffat more than anything else. And for my money, it absolutely was worth the wait, was worth the hype. I think it's incredible. And I think really it's only something that happens with Doctor Who where you can get excited based on who's writing the episode. I can't think of any other series or any series outside of the Whoniverse where I look at it and go, oh, this person's writing that one. That'll be good. But yeah, Moffat's Boom was absolutely fantastic. Took a fairly Moffat-y concept and kind of ran with it. You know, Moffat did really well writing some claustrophobic episodes that sort of didn't really move about settings. Sort of Heaven Sent, the obvious example, but Dark Water doesn't move around particularly much once it gets going, and sort of fairly experimental stuff like that. Yeah, I think this was definitely a winner. So the Doctor stands on a landmine and basically has 45 minutes to get off it and stop it from going off. The ending was perhaps a little bit of a everybody got saved by love Moffat washout, which we've definitely had before. But what led up to that was so brilliant and so intense. And I think for the first time, we really got to see how good an actor Chuty is. Like, wow, what a fantastic performance. And yeah, it just kind of, it built towards a pretty decent finale, pretty decent end of the episode. Claustrophobic, even though it was set on a battlefield, the fact that the Doctor couldn't move made it feel claustrophobic. It was an interesting episode. It was an experimental episode. And I definitely think that we got an absolute Moffat banger there. What about you?
I thought it was great to have Moffat back. Just nice to see him and nice to have his sort of Doctor Who again for 1 week. Boom, I think... I'm not 100% sure what I think. I liked it. It was a very different sort of... It felt almost unconnected to the rest of the series. We didn't get... It doesn't feel of a piece with the rest of the series. And of course it doesn't, because everything else has been written by Russell T. Davies. And in the middle of it, there's this little gem of Stephen Moffat. So it's a bit different and a bit strange. I love the concept, and I think it's a great piece of theatre almost. I've seen a lot of people say that this could work as a stage play, which, you know, would be very, you know, pretty cool to see. I think... Yeah, great to get this sort of unique thing with the Doctor, you not able to run away. I think that was what Stephen Moffat said. There's something the Doctor always does when there's danger, and I've taken away his ability to do it. And he says, see if you can tell what it is. And obviously, it's running away. The Doctor can't run away in this situation. So that's very, very cool that the Doctor has to sort of stand still, especially a Doctor who's such a bundle of energy like this one is, that he has to stand absolutely still and not move, otherwise he's going to wipe out half the planet. Great idea, great concept. I think my biggest problem with this was I know everyone has said that the quality of production, as far as Bad Wolf goes, is top notch. There's no doubting that every other episode has been exceptionally well made. This one, I think the seams showed a little bit. I thought the set they were on looked okay. I thought the CGI background work, you could very clearly tell where the set stopped and the CG background began. This episode, they were using LED screens, like LED walls, Mandalorian style. I thought that showed in a way that other productions using similar ones, you know, don't. So this has been commented on as well, that people on Twitter have pointed this out, but it's very funny that Doctor Who for years and years has gone and shot stuff in quarries. You know, like Doctor Who looks like it's been made in a quarry is a very long running gag. That they get this studio environment and make it look like a quarry. but I thought it felt very claustrophobic, as you say, in not a good way. I didn't really like how this one looked, and I thought it was a bit naff watching the little ambulance thing trundle down that slope at one stage, and it didn't look great, I don't think. To me, anyway, other opinions are available. But great writing, great performances, and probably Susan Twist's most prominent role to date. We haven't really talked about Susan Twist turning up each week, mainly because we have no idea why, and the show hasn't given us any answers on it yet, so there's maybe not too much to talk about there. It's probably just pure speculation, but yeah, it was good. It was a great script and great performances. I can see it being one to revisit in the future, maybe, just to maybe get more out of it, but I liked it.
I do see what you mean about sort of the way it looked. It's a lot of people kind of came away from it, and I saw posting comments of, oh, this looks like the cheap one and everything. I'm like, well, no, it really wasn't. The technology that went into it was, you know, pretty recent and has been pretty impressive across other stuff. But yeah, I do see what you mean. It's kind of, I don't know, there was something definitely missing. I agree with you, but I think it just added to the claustrophobia, and it's not the first time Doctor Who looked a bit cheap. It certainly won't be the last. So I'll take it at face value. I've not a problem with it.
I certainly didn't think it looked cheap. I don't even know what it was that I can put my finger on. I think it just looked too much like a set, if that makes sense. Too manufactured.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe I'm not I see what you mean. You're not incorrect. Certainly. But let's move on to 73 Yards, which is Dr. Light. I believe Chuty was still filming Sex Education when they did this, so this was kind of Millie on her own. And she's brilliant, like incredible. What a performance. Considering that this was like the first time she played the character, she didn't have her co-star to bounce off, and we just got this absolutely amazing sort of performance. It's, again, kind of Russell T. Davis maybe visiting greatest hits. It's very turn lefty. That's what I've seen it compared to. In some ways, I prefer it to turn left, because turn left had the weight of four series worth of storyline on its shoulders. Whereas this was kind of a really, really fresh, like clean break. And it didn't have that what would have happened over the last 4 years if the Doctor had died thing going that Turn Left did. So it allowed it to be a normal episode, and we were just able to get on with it and tell a story. And it was a bit years and yearsy in places, and but yeah, I think generally it worked. I liked that kind of idea being done in a way that wasn't universe or multiverse shattering like Turn Left was. You know, Turn Left had, well, it's Rose's first episode back after a couple of years, and it's, you know, Donna's this amazing person that can fix everything. And there wasn't any of that. And I quite liked that. It was just, what if the Doctor didn't turn up and weird stuff happened to Ruby? And yeah, I like that. It worked for me. Bits of it felt rushed. It kind of felt like there wasn't a real balance to the structure. We spent a lot of time in that pub, and I'd have been very happy with a claustrophobic just in the pub with a weird thing outside episode. But then it suddenly switched and we ended up going to London, and 20 odd years went by, and then another 40 odd years went by, and it did dot about a little bit. You know, the time jumps felt a little bit sort of inconsistent. We didn't get to explore certain parts as maybe would have been as good to. I did like the unit stuff. I liked Kate's appearance, but can we perhaps have a Kate appearance where she's nice? Because she had horrible moments in The Giggle. She had this sort of horrible moment here. It would be nice to kind of have her as a sympathetic character. You know, we're looking at her as the new Brigadier. She's, you know, leading unit. She is the new Brigadier. And the Brigadier disagreed with the Doctor, didn't always have the same ideals with the Doctor, but the Brigadier and the Doctor became the best of friends. And I just don't feel as though we're getting that out of Kate. And I kind of wish that we did. So, yeah, maybe let's have a nice Kate appearance next, please. But otherwise, I quite enjoyed 73 Yards. I think that there's a lot left hanging, and I can't work out whether is it hanging because it's going to be picked up later in the series, or is it hanging because it's leaving the audience to work things out for themselves? And as a Twin Peaks fan, it's not done that very well. It's not done the leave it to the audience to interpret things particularly well. So I'm hoping that maybe we do get a bit of an explanation as to what was going on. But if not, self-contained, fairly decent episode. Definitely can't complain. I thought Millie was absolutely amazing. Over to you, Connor.
I have two opinions on this. So there's the opinion that I have of 73 Yards when I'm watching it, and then there's the opinion of what I have of 73 Yards when the credits have rolled and it's over and done. I think this is one. So when you're watching it, I think this is a very compelling, very well made piece of television. And I was on the very edge of my seat when the credits roll and you haven't got any sort of answer or explanation or even a hint as to what's going on. My opinion of it crashes. And I don't like to be, I don't want me to make it seem like I'm sticking the boot or anything into this, but I find it quite frustrating. So I love stuff like Ghost Story for Christmas and stuff like that. All those M.R. James, creepy countryside ghost stories. There's a lot of that sort of thing, very evident in the early stages of this when it's still in Wales and Ruby's. In the pub and what on, you know, on the coast, that sort of thing. A lot of The Woman in Black, actually, a colleague lent me a copy of the 1989 ITV Nigel Neal Woman in Black adaptation, and there's an awful lot of that in this. Very, very clearly influenced it. Just with the woman standing in the field and watching Ruby from afar. So that was really cool. I believe he actually did that deliberately, that he said, you know, watch this before you watch 73 Yards. So I'm very grateful to him for that. I love all that sort of thing, and I thought the early stages were great. It sort of goes and then becomes, as you say, a years and years clone with Ruby and the politician, which is fine. I think I maybe expected a bigger role for him. The stuff with Kate's okay. It was not, I wasn't expecting to see Kate. It was great to see her. So I loved that. Bit of a blink and you'll miss it. She was there for a scene and then disappeared again. Fine. And then you get the whole thing going through. I don't think the whole politics thing holds up. Because yes, it's cool. I love that whole sort of right-wing party Britain sliding into fascism thing. It's one of my favourite types of story, and I love seeing that in Doctor Who. I love stuff like SSGB, that sort of what if Britain but fascist. I love exploring that sort of world through fiction. I'd obviously never want to see it happen for real life. But it's cool. I just think it was a bit weird the way it played out, and maybe wasn't as significant as we'd been led to believe. When you get to the end of this and there's no explanation as to what happened, fine, I don't need an explanation. Sure, I can imagine for myself what's happened, but I, as you say, I don't think this was done all that well here. I didn't feel satisfied having got to the ending of it. It just seemed a bit weird and a bit random and without any real basis. Since then, I think Russell has come out and explained it a little bit more. It's meant to be that when the Doctor breaks the fairy circle, it's some sort of fae being or fairy being that makes Ruby live a life of penitence for having disrespected the circle. Great, fine. I play Dungeons and Dragons. I can deal with fae and fairies no problem. I know how that world is meant to work. But there's beyond the fact that it's a fairy circle, which could be any number of things in Doctor Who, it's not explicitly said that this is a fae creature or a fae being. There's no explanation of that in the episode itself. You know, you don't get enough, I think, in 73 Yards to satisfyingly end it. And I didn't feel satisfied after watching it, I have to say. I thought, you know, while you're watching it, all the stuff with Ruby being abandoned. It's all really great drama. As I say, the word I keep coming back to is, when I'm watching this, I think it's really compelling stuff. But I don't think it sticks the landing. And I think that inability to finish in a satisfying way affects the whole piece, in that I don't enjoy the memory of having seen 73 yards. So great. I love when Doctor Who does weird stuff. I love seeing stuff that's not the run of the mill. As we said at the start, Millie Gibson was superb, and fair play to her for carrying an episode like this. Excellent performance. I wish they had maybe kept the timescale on her finding the Albion party a little shorter, because I did not buy for a minute that the Ruby was 40 years old. She doesn't look 40 years old in any way, shape or form. But great performance. Just, I think it's a shame the way it turned out, and I can't get behind the episode as a result of that. I like the explanation, as Russell says, of it being a fae being that sort of takes the Doctor and sentences Ruby to live this life of penitence. I think that's a good explanation. But this is something again that's maybe coloured my thing, my reading of it, is every Doctor Who fan and their aunt has written their own interpretation of what it means, and I've had to read through hundreds of these. I think this is what happened. Someone brought up the Minister of War from that Capaldi story and said, oh, this was that, you know, this was the Minister of War, and it's like, no, it wasn't. It's nothing to do with that. Like, fine, you can make that connection, but I don't think we as Doctor Who fans should be sitting here coming up with our own explanation for a story like this. I like that in other places, but I don't think it worked here.
So I'm very shortly going to contradict what I'm about to say, but I kind of wish this was a two-parter. I kind of wish we'd have had a bit more time to explore Ruby's life. I wish we'd have had a bit more time for the actual nastiness of this fascist party kicking in, because basically all we got was these guys are fascist and a little bit of subtext with a character that kind of pops in, provides the subtext, and then that's it, they're gone, we don't see them again. I just kind of, yeah, you know, we could have spread this out, and there are two Doctor Light episodes in this series, so this could have been a Ruby-led sort of Doctorless two-parter, and I'd have been okay with that, and the story would have had more time to breathe, the threat would have felt more threatening, and there'd have been a little bit more room for explanation. I think of everything that we've had so far in this series, this is the one that deserves to be a bit longer, because it feels rushed at 45, 50 minutes, whatever it was. That being said, if it had been a two-parter, we wouldn't have got Dot and Bubble, which I loved. I thought was absolutely excellent. And therefore, actually, I'm happy with 73 Yards only being the one part, because Dot and Bubble is another excellent way of doing a Doctor Light episode. So we'll move on to Dot and Bubble, which at the time of recording is the most recent episode. So this is the last one we're going to look at today. We'll do another episode where we talk about the last three and kind of review the series as a whole. But Dot and Bubble, a sort of fairly on-the-nose comment on social media, people being in their own bubble, that kind of thing. Really clever episode, though. This series is doing subtlety very well. As I said, there was some pretty nasty subtext in 73 Yards. We've got some subtext throughout this episode that kind of does give you a bit of a gut punch at the end. I've seen lots of comments ranging from, oh, yep, I saw it coming, to, wow, that really got me, and I've gone back and watched it, and the signs are all there. And I think that's a good thing. I think being able to drop things that subtly so that you can pick up on something through 45 minutes, but also there's a nice little shock at the end if you didn't. I think that's a really good thing, a good way of doing it. Personally, I definitely picked up on a lot of the stuff. Not all of it. There were things that I didn't sort of recognise. And this episode has been written about more than any other, I think. I've seen more written about this, more interpretations about this than I have 73 Yards. And as we've said, 73 Yards was kind of in places left open to interpretation, whereas this hit you like a hammer at the end, very effectively so. I like the episode. You know, the monsters weren't the priority here, but they were there and they were effective monsters, I guess. I don't think there was any real explanation for why they were doing what they were doing and how they were doing it. But at the same time, the people that were doing it to were pretty dreadful. So I guess that kind of negates any need for that question in Hooniverse terms. But yeah, good episode. Definitely very little I can pick out of it. Pick at it with negatively. And I thought it was very, very gripping. And I think that's something we've had a lot of this series. While you're watching it, while you're in the moment, as you said, Connor, it's all very gripping. It's very engaging. So what are your thoughts on Dot and Bubble?
I loved it. I'm glad that there's been at least one episode that has come out of this series that I can say I unconditionally love, that I thought everything was fantastic. So Dr. Light, but it doesn't feel like it, I don't think, just as much certainly as 73 Yards, because the Doctor is present throughout in the bubbles and, you know, on people's screens. I knew going into this, I'd heard a rumor that the twist at the end, that these people were going to be racist towards the Doctor. So that was in the back of my head while watching, and I did pick up on the things they were saying, and the microaggressions, as people have called them, which it's absolutely true. They are microaggressions. That's the very definition of what they are. But I thought it was superb. I thought Callie Cook was, in the same way that Carrie Mulligan was great, you know, to lead Blink as a guest star, Callie Cook was great to lead this as Lindy. Really outstanding performance, and a lot of people have said she's going to go far, and I think she absolutely will. The whole stuff about social media and its evils maybe is not so new material. It's I don't think this has anything to say about social media that has not been said before by something like Black Mirror or the news, quite frankly. But it's cool seeing that play out in Doctor Who. Couple of nice twists along the way. I loved the whole thing with Ricky September and the way she turned on him, because that takes her from being, a bit of an annoying person and, sort of vapid, unlikable social media addicted person to actually you're a bit of a not nice person. There's a little bit of a streak in Lindy then that makes itself known, that obviously gets played out then when the Doctor has his confrontation with her at the end. I thought that was good. The Man-Eaters were a great villain. They look cool. The Man-Eaters or the Man-Traps or whatever they call look really cool. So that's great. And I like the whole thing about the AI, because it's so closely tied to these guys' social media, it knows exactly what they're like and decides to do them in. That's great. That's quite funny. That's quite cool. To make a villain. The whole bit where Ricky September, where she turns on him and dobs him in as Richard, as Ricky Combs or whatever his name was, unexpectedly violent and unexpectedly graphic. Now, I don't think they show blood, but there's a red light that's obviously meant to stand in for blood when he gets his head blasted through by the Dot. So that's, I didn't expect them to go that far in Doctor Who, and certainly not in Disney Doctor Who. So it makes this era feel maybe like it has slightly more teeth, and it's maybe going to do things that we haven't seen in Doctor Who before, and I thought that was pretty cool. Not cool as in, oh no, this guy got his head blasted through, but it feels not like Doctor Who. It feels like going a step beyond. So yeah, great. And then obviously the ending scene, which again, in the same way that 73 Yards was the first thing Mel Gibson did, this was the first thing that Shudi Gatwa did as the Doctor. And what a performance in that final scene. Carried it brilliantly. My only complaint with that whole final scene is I wish, as soon as it became clear that those guys weren't going to accept their help, and as soon as they said what they did to the Doctor and were clear about what they thought of him, I wish As that little boat was sailing through the tunnel out into the world beyond, I wish the Doctor and Ruby had got into the TARDIS, and I wish they had let them see Lindy and the other fine timers. I wish they had let them see the TARDIS leave, and I wish they sailed off into the forest knowing that they could have been saved, but didn't. They turned it down because of their bigotry. I wish that's the only change I would have made. I wish they had seen the TARDIS leave, and I wish they knew that they had given up this way of escaping because of their bigotry. That's my only complaint about the whole thing. Or the only thing I would have changed about the whole thing. I love the episode. I think it's the best of the series so far. It's maybe the best of this whole new era for me. I just loved it to bits, and I'm really excited for going into next week now.
I'm genuinely torn as to whether this or Boom is my favourite so far this series. Like they're both very, very good for very, very different reasons. They do very different things. And both of them have an absolutely amazing performance from Shooty, like incredible stuff. I kind of wish that Capaldi had got some stuff more like this to get his teeth into. Like, Capaldi's an amazing actor, and I never felt as though he really got to really act to the sort of more towards the limits of his abilities until Zygon Inversion came along, which was more than halfway through his era. But this kind of stuff for a Doctor in the first series is brilliant, and it's just been played so damn well. If we're going to get even just moments like the last few minutes of Dot and Bubble at Shooty, we really are on for a very special Doctor performance over the next few years, hopefully. But yeah, great episode. The, like we said, you know, the hints about the racism, they were there all the way through. Little comments, little things said, little things that appeared on a screen, but it wasn't until that final moment that you get the actual gut punch of, wow, these are all absolutely dreadful people. And I like the fact that it was, I agree with you actually, that them seeing the Doctor and Ruby leave would have been far more effective. But I like the fact that their ending's left ambiguous. Kind of, it's heavily implied that all they've done is delay a rather horrible death by not much time at all. But we don't see it. We don't get that confirmation at all. So, it was at least a partially effective way of ending it. But I really like the idea of them sort of seeing what they'd turned down through their bigotry. That could have been just slightly more effective, I think. But that's it. That's Doctor Who so far. That's Series 1 so far, or Series 14, or Series 40, or whatever you want to call it. Series 1. It's Series 1 so far. Season 1. Season 1 so far.
Let's call it Jeff. We're that's as far as we are through Jeff.
Yeah. So that's that so far. And I have enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed it. I'm starting to feel a week by week excitement for Doctor Who again, which I don't think I've properly had since, Ascension of the Cybermen, Timeless Children, that sort of hype for next week's episode. That, oh, I really want to see it now. I'm looking forward to it.
This is the thing with Rogue, is that this is the first episode of Doctor Who that hasn't been written by a showrunner, by one of the three showrunners, since 2020.
Yes.
Every other episode since then has had a credit by Chris Chibnall, by Russell T Davies, or by Stephen Moffat.
Which is kind of mad, but perhaps also the best way to start this new era. I mean, you know, Flux was a sort of matter of necessity, really, with COVID and everything. But obviously, Russell T Davies has come in and gone, I am very much setting out the rails for the direction of this new series before anybody else can jump on the train. And I think he's already said going forward that will change. There's going to be less Russell. There are going to be more guest writers, and I'm looking forward to that. But it'll be very interesting to see what we get with Rogue. It'll be interesting to see just a new take on Doctor Who, the first new take on Doctor Who for a very, very long time.
Yes, I'm looking forward to seeing what is happening with this Rogue character. Very clearly, I think, going to be a love interest for the Doctor. I think whether it's going to be a sort of like love-hate thing, whether they're sort of antagonistic to each other, but they maybe are sort of like see something each other across that divide, I don't know. I certainly, having seen the clips now, I did sort of wonder for a while if that whole rumor of this being Captain Jack with extreme plastic surgery was going to come true, but I've seen the some of the clips now and I don't think it is Jack. I'm interested to see what happens. Russell has said there's some significance to this story, that it's going to change things going forward. No idea what that could possibly be. Looking forward to finding out what it is. We'll see. And then we're not very far from the finale. I'm ready for answers now. So there's a lot of threads that have been left hanging. The likes of the one who waits, Mrs. Flood, Susan Twist's character, Beep the Meep's boss, whether that's the same as any, whether these people are all different characters or whether they're the same, I don't know. I think it's very clear that there's something going on. It's going to involve the TARDIS or TARDISes in some way, because Russell, there's been a few different things. Russell said there was some significance to Mrs. Flood's door. When you look at the door of her flat, it's a TARDIS door. It's the four wooden panels painted in a blue colour. It looks like the Doctor's TARDIS. She obviously knew what the TARDIS was, or she knew what a TARDIS was in Church on Ruby Road. Which I love. I like that. I love characters turning up and knowing what a TARDIS is. Not necessarily the TARDIS, but knowing what a TARDIS is. That's quite cool. Susan Twist's character is rumoured to be called Susan Triad, and S Triad is an anagram of TARDIS. There's been something going on with the Doctor's TARDIS that has almost been sort of drowned out by everything else. In Wild Blue Yonder, just after it's crashed into the ship, it makes a noise and the Doctor says, oh no, that's something else. That's not that we've crashed. There's something else going on there. Same thing happens in The Devil's Cord, where the TARDIS has just returned to 1963. It's a rough flight. They come out and the TARDIS makes the same noise. And Ruby says, oh, is it ill or is it damaged? And he says, no, this is something else. So there's something going on with the Doctor's TARDIS that has sort of flown under the radar, that it's not working fully, you know, well. It's been crashing a lot more into stuff. Like they haven't just materialized, it's been crashing into its landings. So maybe there's something that the TARDIS isn't well, or it's been poisoned. I don't know. I think that's maybe going to come up in the finale. I want answers to these questions now. I think the teasing has gone on long enough. They need to start answering some of what's going on with Ruby and the snow, and with Mrs. Flood and Susan Twist and the TARDIS and Beep the Meep's boss, and all of these things are going on and on. And I want answers to them now, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm answer ready now. And by the next time we record one of these, we shall have answers.
I hope.
Excitingly. Please. Yes. But that is all we've got time for now. So we'll be back in a few weeks where we'll look at the rest of the series and kind of go over it as a whole. But for now, I will say goodbye to Connor.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back for more Spodcasting in a few weeks. Goodbye now.
There's always a clip at the end.